Thank you for listening to this podcast from TRE, Talk Radio Europe, your voice in Spain and around the world. For more information, please visit tre.radio.
The TRE Book Show is sponsored by Audible. Click on the Audible banner on the talkradioeurope.com homepage to download your free audiobook today. Terms and conditions apply.
The Book Programme, presented by Hannah Murray.
Good evening. Welcome to tonight's book show. My first guest is Daniel Blythe, who started his writing career on the new Doctor Who adventures in 1993. He's the author of many books, including the acclaimed novels The Cut and Losing Faith. His latest novel, Exiles, is a young adult sci-fi adventure that started as a secret writing project when he was a schoolboy. Also with us is Hayley Webster, a mentor on the 2019 National Writers' Centre Escalator Scheme. Her latest novel, One Christmas Night, is the feel-good Christmas book of 2019. It's set on one street in Norwich and follows all the people who live there as presents have gone missing from people's homes. We also have Beverly Bowery, who's written around 80 fun columns for her local newspaper. Her debut children's novel, Charlie Palmer Says, is a ghostly adventure for readers aged 9 to 11. And finally on tonight's book show is Richard Granger, who divides his time between Poland and Marbella. His debut novel, Losing the Plot, is the first in the Richie Malone series. It's about a male writer who writes highly successful pornographic fiction under a female pseudonym. Richie finds himself caught up in a turf war between the Russian mafia, Irish gangsters, and a Colombian cartel. That's all on tonight's book show on Talk Radio Europe.
The Book Programme, presented by Hannah Murray. The Book Programme, presented by Hannah Murray.
Joining us on the line now from the UK is Daniel Blythe, who started his writing career on the new Doctor Who adventures in 1993. He's the author of many books, including the acclaimed novels The Cut, Losing Faith and This Is the Day, the best-selling encyclopedia of classic 80s pop and the light-hearted parental guide Dadlands. His new novel is called Exiles. It's a young adult sci-fi adventure, which was inspired by a secret writing project that was born when he was a schoolboy. Welcome to the book show, Daniel.
Hello, Hannah.
Hi, thanks very much for joining us. And how exciting to have done a book that has kind of been in you for such a long time.
Well, it has, yes. I mean, I think I used to do a lot of writing when I was younger, and I started out actually wanting to write comics, and I used to sit on the swing in my parents' garden and would think about stories in my head, because I was always quite a visual thinker, and I would imagine the story in my head before I even went and wrote anything down. So something when I go and talk to schools that I show is my first ever comic, which was called The Computer Mice, which I show a slide of just to entertain them. But yes, I wrote a lot of kind of science fiction-y type stuff when I was younger and kind of went away from that as an adult, but came back to it a bit to do the latest book.
So tell us about how you started in writing and your writing career. I mentioned the new Doctor Who adventures. How did that come about?
Yes, well, Doctor Who was the first incarnation of Doctor Who, if you like, was shown on BBC television between 1963 and 89. And when it was finally cancelled, the incumbent Doctor was Sylvester McCoy, who I think was very good and quite underrated. And an editor at Virgin Books called Peter Darvill Evans had the rights to do original Doctor Who novels for the first time. So he was inundated with manuscripts from Doctor Who fans and actually invited us to send them in, which was quite a strange thing to be happening in the sort of early to mid-90s when publishers were cutting back their lists and saying, you know, it's a terrible time to get published. Lots of young writers got published for the first time in this new Doctor Who Adventures range. My book was called The Dimension Riders, and it came out when I was just 24 years old, which is quite terrifying, really. And I knew nothing at all about writing or the industry. So I did a couple for them, and then I got an agent on the basis of a manuscript called The Cut, which was my first original novel. Not science fiction at all, a contemporary novel set in a seaside town about middle-class children getting into trouble doing joyriding and drugs and so on. And it was taken up by Tony Lacey at Penguin Books and published, thanks to my wonderful agent, Caroline Montgomery, who sold it to Penguin.
Fantastic.
And things just carried on from there, really.
And how was it writing, when you were writing the Doctor Who stories, are you kind of restricted into, you know, who you can write about and the different characters and things? There must be sort of guidelines that you have to go by.
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, in the Virgin Books days, they were pushing the envelope a bit, and their slogan, their strap line was too broad and deep for the small screen. So they were very much into doing stories that couldn't have been done on screen. So they had some sort of adult ideas and big sci-fi concepts which the BBC special effects department couldn't have realized. When I came back to Doctor Who later on, I wrote a story for the David Tennant Doctor called Autonomy, and it was a little bit more restricted. You had to be more careful, tying into the feel of Doctor Who at the time, which is fair enough, which is what I wanted to do and what the people in charge of Doctor Who wanted to do at the time. So it's quite a different couple of experiences, really, doing Doctor Who for Virgin and doing Doctor Who for the BBC.
Yeah, I bet. And then you to obviously have the freedom when you did The Cut to do whatever you like.
Yes, I mean, that was a book which I'd I've been thinking about for a long time. And when I eventually sat down to write it, I wrote it quite quickly. I wrote it in about 5 or 6 months. And I tried my best not to make it autobiographical. I think the problem with a lot of first novels is that they are thinly disguised autobiographies. So I made the narrator a 17-year-old girl, and I was a 26-year-old man at the time. My second novel, Losing Faith, is probably more autobiographical. That has more about, more inspired by my life at university and my friends and what they went on to do. Thereafter, I tried not to fall into the autobiographical trap too much.
Yeah. So looking at this latest book, then what can you tell us about it, Exiles?
Well, yeah, Exiles was inspired by really wanting to do a story about an isolated group of people. And because I'd written young adult books, I'd written the Shadowrunners books and the Emerald Green books for probably the younger end of the young adult market. So, you know, 11, 12, 13-year-olds enjoy those. This is a tougher, grittier book. I very much say it's for, you know, mid-teens and above, and a lot of adults will enjoy it too. It's the story of a prison colony in the future, and a group of these young reprobates who've been sent to basically be exiled for life and to set up a society, a colony on this far-flung world. And they've been there for 8 months and been sort of struggling to survive. And then this outsider comes in, a girl called Beth, who is an arrival in an escape pod from a disaster on a colony spaceship. And you're never quite sure whether you can entirely trust her story, or even if she completely knows what her story is. And the story is told from several different perspectives. Beth is the main character, but she's the outsider, so we see the colony through her eyes. And there are things that obviously start to happen, weird events, sabotage, and there's a violent incident halfway through the book, of which Beth, as the outsider, is immediately suspected. The truth is perhaps a little bit more complicated than that.
And do we like Beth? Are we kind of rooting for her?
Yeah, I think she is a likable character. I mean, she is a member of something called the Chapter of Continual Progress, which is not a religious order. It's more something which kind of celebrates the progress of science. So in a way, kind of sees science and technology as almost a religion. And then she finds herself in a situation where the technology is very ramshackle and society, you know, is very much living on the edge. And so a lot of her assumptions are challenged, and she's a real fish out of water, and someone who's not kind of tough like the prison inmates, and has to learn how to defend herself and how to fight and so on. So yeah, we are kind of on her side in the book. Yeah.
And how long does it take you to put the books together, would you say?
Well, it very much depends. I mean, I've done some very much shorter books in my time. I've done some books for a company called Badger Learning, who do reluctant reader books for people who don't cope so well with a longer book. And I can do one of those in a very short space of time, because they're under 100 pages. Something like Exiles has come out at nearly 500 pages. And so it took me probably 3 years or so on and off working on it. And yeah, I mean, that was not working on it every single day, but certainly doing some thinking about it most days. And I found with the last 100 pages, they really wouldn't come together. I had to go back and rewrite it, because I wanted to get the end absolutely right. It grows and grows in intensity throughout. It's a whodunit, and it's a thriller, and it you know, the pace gets sharper and more intense as the book progresses. And it was just very hard to get those last 100 pages right. So I spent a lot of time on those. And my agent was champing at the bit, you know, wanting to know when the book would be ready to be sent out into the world. And I kept telling her, it's almost ready. And then eventually you get to the point where you have to say, right, I am happy with this book. I'm ready for it to go out into the world. And you kind of take a deep breath and wait for somebody to like it.
It must be quite a relief when it's done.
It is, yes. I mean, I always feel very proud. I mean, even after, you know, 20-odd years of being published, I still get a great sense of achievement of finally seeing the thing in print and getting my box full of my copies to give out to people. And it's nice to know that people are reading it and enjoying it and reviewing it. And like I say, it's not just a book for teenagers, it's a book for adults as well. So anybody who likes thought-provoking adventure fiction will hopefully enjoy it. You don't have to be a sci-fi fan to enjoy it.
It's interesting, isn't it? It's one of those genres, sci-fi, that some people think, oh no, I don't like sci-fi, but then they'll find themselves really enjoying a sci-fi book or a series or a film and think, oh, actually, I really enjoyed that.
Yeah, I know. I think genre can be off-putting. I mean, people like to label books, and I think writers don't so much label books, and it's booksellers perhaps who do it. They like to say, this is crime, this is romance, this is sci-fi, and, you know, yeah, people just like stories about characters that make choices. And I always, when I do my talks in schools, I use Star Wars as an example, and I go through the plot of the first Star Wars and show how it's a story about characters making choices all the way, and choices that impact upon the plot. You know, plots are not just things that happen to characters. Characters make stories happen. And so whether your story is set in, you know, Victorian England or, you know, contemporary America or futuristic far-flung colony in outer space or in a fantasy land, as long as it's about characters and characters that people can root for and who are making choices and making things happen and having consequences of those choices, then that's going to be a story that people can be involved in and interested in.
Yeah, absolutely. It must be fun going to the schools and doing the talks and getting the feedback from the kids.
Yeah, I mean, it is. It's part of my job. I mean, a lot of young adults and children's writers do that around the UK, and worldwide as well. It is. I mean, it's almost like an essential part of work now. I mean, I visit about 30 schools a year, both primary and secondary. And we get a lot of good stuff, a lot of really interesting questions from the kids, a lot of great writing as well. And I normally work with kind of the very youngest would be 7-year-olds and the going up to kind of 15, 16-year-olds. But I had a group in a school in Salford, in Manchester recently. I had a group of year twos, younger than I would normally work with. And I said, yes, I'm very happy to work with the year twos as long as they have some prepared questions. So I went in and there's these very bright, alert young children sitting there ready to do their questions. And I had a lot of the usual questions, like how long does it take to write a book and so on. And then I had one girl who said to me a question which really made me think. I thought, this is so good that a 6-year-old can be asking me this. And she said, why is your job important? And that really made me think, why is my job important? So I had to try and explain, you know, why it is that what we do is valuable in a way that a 6-year-old could understand. And that was a really good challenge for me.
Oh, lovely. Great question.
Yeah, it was, yeah. And the next question they asked was how do you pray? So I thought we'd better move on from that a bit. It was a religious school.
Fantastic. Well, if people want to get a copy of your latest book, it is called Exiles, and it's available to buy on our website in the TRE bookshop section, and it's by Daniel Blythe, who we've been chatting to today. Daniel, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you, Hannah. It's been a pleasure.
The TRE Book Show is sponsored by Audible. Click on the Audible banner on the talkradioeurope.com homepage to download your free audiobook today. Terms and conditions apply.
The Book Programme. Presented by Hannah Murray.
Joining us on the line now from the UK is Hayley Webster, who did a sold-out event at the Edinburgh Festival last year. She's also a mentor on the 2019 National Writers' Centre Escalator Scheme. She's back with us on the book show to talk about her latest novel, One Christmas Night, described as the feel-good Christmas book of 2019. It's all about connection and community. Welcome to the book show, Hayley.
Thank you very much.
It must be lovely setting a book around Christmas time. Does it kind of give you the warm, fuzzy feeling when you're writing it?
It really does, funnily enough. It really does. And some of the things I wanted to write about before I tried to write about and not found the way to make them uplifting or give that sort of bit of magic to it. And actually setting it at Christmas kind of, it gave it that thing that it needed.
You know? Yeah. So how did you come about the story? Where did you get the idea for the setting and the plot and everything from? Do you know?
When I first moved to Norwich in about 2003, although all my family are from Norfolk and always been from Norfolk, and I lived in one of those Victorian house shares, the terrace houses that Norwich have, and I thought how great it would be to write a book set on one of those streets because there's so many different types of people living on a street like that, and you've got rented houses and owned houses and student houses. And I thought, oh, I'd love to set one going in and out of the houses, but I never found a way to do it. I sort of wrote a few little bits and pieces but couldn't find a way to link them. And then a couple of Christmases ago I wrote some tweets about a Christmas present, and a publisher got in touch to say, oh, have you ever thought about writing a book based at Christmas? And the two ideas merged together, and I said, actually, what about setting it on one street at Christmas, every chapter in a different house or place on the street from all different perspectives? And it sort of clicked that way.
Yeah, really. It's a lovely idea. And your tweets that you wrote a few years ago were retweeted by so many people. It was a really wonderful story that you told. Can you just share it with us?
Yeah, I think I was just sort of rambling on Twitter thinking about the best present I'd ever had. And it was actually a piece of sheet music pushed through the door before I was 10 of the snowman. And it was my dad's girlfriend. And she just noticed what I needed, I think. And she popped it through and she said it was from the elves, Santa's elves, I think, and popped it through the door. And so when I opened it, it was there. And it just felt really wonderful to be noticed. And so the tweets were about being noticed, and noticing people is the key to make people feel good about themselves and to feel good about yourself. So
yeah,
it was
absolutely. And Christmas is a good time for people to be able to do that if maybe they're not doing it throughout the rest of the year, which is obviously the aim.
yeah, well, it's a reminder of that and what can be done. And also a lot of people who are forgotten about the rest of the year, who shouldn't be. I try to include lots of characters in the book who might not necessarily automatically be having a happy Christmas for lots of different reasons, and think about how we could all make people feel valued, not just at Christmas.
Yeah. So tell us about the different characters living on the street, can you?
Yeah, there's quite a few. I think it's told from 9 perspectives, the actual story, but there's more characters than that. So there's Joni Blake, who is in her mid-20s, a teaching assistant and a cleaner, lives with her 2 children. And then there's her girlfriend, Irma, who works in the pub and is a care leaver, who has a secret that you don't really understand what it's about. And the story sort of unfolds, you find out more about her. There's an estate agent with lots of nice cars, and his wife, who makes perfect Christmas dinners and things like that. There's a pub. So there's the landlord of the pub, Larry, and his wife, Sue. There's a couple of teenagers, Rocky and Tash. Basically, there's all these different people who are all interconnected. And you sort of see little flashes of their lives. And all of them are sort of getting over the death of Joni's mum, Ali, who we don't meet in the book, but it's the first Christmas that they've all had without her around. So that's kind of, you know, yeah.
It must have been lovely creating all the different characters.
It was. I got into it too much, really. And actually, I drew a map of the street and made little cutouts of the characters and would move them around. I'm revealing too much. But I really liked visually thinking how they would physically connect and disconnect on the street. And I got, you know, I drew pictures of them all, and I know lots about them that doesn't feature in the book. You know, I know what songs they like and all these things, even though they're made up. I really enjoyed that. That was probably the best thing about writing, I think.
That's both really cute and really obsessive.
You summed up something that I probably didn't want to, but there we are, it's out there now. Yeah.
So when you finished the book, was it really sad kind of leaving the characters behind? I mean, do you think they could come back in another book, or is that it now?
Yeah, I would really, there's a few, I would love to write a series, I suppose, of interconnected books or with characters in Norwich, sort of set in around Norwich, with occasional ones from previous books passing over. I'd love to do that. And there's a couple of detective constables in One Christmas Night, DC Crane and DC Addo, and I would love to have them investigating other crimes, because in this one there's lots of Christmas presents going missing on the street, and they're there to try and work out who's been doing it. And so it would be quite nice to carry them over.
Yeah, sounds like a lovely idea. Well, if people want to get a copy of One Christmas Night, it's available to buy on our website in the TRE bookshop section, and it's by Hayley Webster, who we've been chatting to. Hayley, thanks ever so much for joining us, and Merry Christmas.
Merry Christmas to you. Thank you.
The TRE Book Show is sponsored by Audible. Click on the Audible banner on the talkradioeurope.com homepage to download your free audiobook today. Terms and conditions apply.
The Book Programme, presented by Hannah Murray.
Joining us on the line from the UK is Beverly Bowery, who has written around 80 fun columns for her local newspaper. She's with us on the book show to talk about her debut children's novel. It's called Charlie Palmer Says, and it's a rip-roaring ghostly adventure for readers aged 9 to 11. Welcome to the book show, Beverly.
Hello, Hannah. Thank you for having me on your show.
Oh, it's a pleasure. Thanks very much for joining us. And congratulations on your debut novel. It must be very exciting.
It's extremely exciting. It's something I've been waiting to do all my life. So finally it's happened. It feels like a dream come true, to be quite honest.
Oh, how lovely. And with all the newspaper articles that you've written, do you think it's all been good sort of training and grounding for this?
I'm sure it is. Actually, I originally applied to write a column for my newspaper in 1986, and I came second. So I was pipped at the post. And, yes, and 20 years later, they advertised for a similar sort of column to be written, only you had to come up with your own idea, and I thought, I'll write a column for having fun in your 50s, which I did. I sent that in, and this time I actually got picked. So I wrote about 80 columns for them, a monthly column, and it was just fun. I just wrote about things that were in the news, things that were happening to me. I was studying for a degree in English and media at that point, and virtually everyone in my group were about 30 years younger than me, so I picked up some interesting snippets of conversation, and I'm sure all of this has helped me. Yes, basically.
Oh, how lovely. What a fun column that must have been to write.
It was great fun, and I also, back then, I was a soap addict, so I quite often wrote about TV programs and compared myself to these people and what you could be doing in your 50s rather than just sitting at home knitting or whatever.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So with your book, Charlie Palmer Says, who is Charlie Palmer?
Well, it all came about when I was at my cousin's triplets' birthday party several years ago. They were 10 at the time. They're now teenagers. But back then, it was a very hot day. I was at their 10th birthday party at their house. The children were all in the garden playing, and there was a table indoors with all food laid out on it. And I happened to be helping the mum dish out the food. And every so often, one of the triplets, called whose name happened to be Charles, so they used the name Charlie Palmer for this other boy to be able to differentiate between them. He kept coming in and saying things like, Charlie Palmer says, can he have a sandwich? And then he came back a few minutes later and said, Charlie Palmer says, can he have some crisps? And then a few minutes later, he was back again. Charlie Palmer says, can he have some jelly? And he came back several times asking for things that Charlie Palmer said he wanted. And I was sitting nearby and my writing antennae were up. And I thought, hello, this sounds interesting. Who is Charlie Palmer? In fact, I never got to see him. And his mum, you know, said, well, as I said, why can't Charlie Palmer come in and ask for this food by himself? And Charles, well, he replied, but I never heard because at that point I was too busy making up a story. So basically, Charlie Palmer was a guest at my cousin's triplet's birthday party, but I never got to see him. I had no idea who he was. And when I saw the triplet, Charles, standing there asking all these questions, at that time he had the most gorgeous white blonde curly hair. And in my mind, I thought, right, Charlie Palmer's going to be a ghost. And I decided to make the other triplets characters in the book. So one of the triplets, who was William, became Nathan, who is the protagonist, and the other triplet, Kerry, became Nathan's confidant, Hattie, his future stepsister. So basically, that's why it came about. And if I hadn't have gone to that birthday party, Charlie Palmer Says would never have happened, basically.
Oh, how lovely. So I bet the family are thrilled that you've done this book, are they?
They're absolutely over the moon, and I think if you can see, look inside the book, it actually has a dedication for Kerry, Charles and William, and I obviously asked their permission if I could write about them in this way, although I never named them in the actual book, and apart from the dedication, and they said they were absolutely thrilled to bits, and they've been waiting all this time, and as I said, they're now teenagers, but... they're incredibly happy.
Oh, so, fantastic. So tell us about the Charlie Palmer character, who's a ghost. How does that feature then?
Well, apparently he was murdered in the 1980s, and he turns up at this house. Nathan and his mum and his older sister have had to move into this house because the mum has split up with the dad, and they've had to move into another property. So the property is new to them, and Charlie Palmer has been hanging around, literally, for about 30 years, waiting to be able to be seen by somebody, and it's only because Nathan goes out on Christmas Day with his brand-new metal detector that Charlie is able to appear. And he basically warns Charlie that there are some people living down the road who are... jewel thieves, and also murdered him, and he wants justice. He can't rest until he's got justice, and Nathan promises to get it for him. And Charlie actually was in a children's home, so there's no sort of parents around looking for him. So that's basically the gist of the story, and it's Nathan and Hattie trying to help Charlie get justice for his murder, and also stopping a jewel raid that's going to take place in the town centre.
Wow, great story. Lots of aspects to it. Did you plan a lot beforehand? Did you kind of know exactly what was going to happen in each chapter, or did you just start writing and see what happens?
Well, I did write myself a few basic notes that I had a rough idea of how it was going to start and how it was going to finish. But at one point, I thought I need to add a bit more to it. So I did add the mum and the future stepdad going off to a cake-off competition. You've obviously got to get the parents out of the way so the children get on with whatever they need to do. And I did have a basic idea of what was going to happen. But as I said, I had it sort of set out. I wrote it on postcards, actually. I wrote little bits what I was going to have happen in each chapter. And then I decided to add on a bit about somebody with a generator, a very old man who now lives in the care home where Charlie Palmer was originally, which was a children's home. And it's actually basically his generator that enabled the metal detector to pick up Charlie Palmer and make him appear as a ghost. So I did add additions, but the idea originally was this poor ghost wandering about looking for dusters. But it did take me a while to come up with the idea of the metal detector. And it was only because I thought, I'm going to have Nathan interested in history. I suddenly thought, what could he possibly have that would make him have a ghost appear? And I thought of lightsabers, all sorts of things. And then I thought, metal detector. I looked into it. I could see that you can get children's metal detectors. And one of the main features in the story is the fact that the batteries have almost run out. So Nathan is frantic because he thinks he's not going to be able to make contact with Charlie again. And so a lot of the book is dedicated to Nathan dashing around looking for batteries for his metal detector as well. But yes, I did have a rough idea of where I was going at the beginning.
Yeah. And now you've written the book and it's published, it's out there. Have you started writing another book? Could there be a follow-up to this?
Well, I haven't got another idea for Charlie Palmer at the moment, but if people are keen on him, then I may well produce another, because I did have him in the book say to another ghost, or the other ghost is saying, well, you might be able to appear, but, and at that point something happens, so you never know whether Charlie Palmer will be able to appear again or not. But I had already written another book, actually, nothing to do with Charlie Palmer. It's been sitting in the drawer for 30 years, and it may well get an airing now. I was originally told about 30 years ago it was too long for a first-time author. So I've chopped it down, and in recent months I've been altering it and changing it, and that might get an airing shortly.
Oh, well done you.
I've also got another one on the back burner. But at the end of the day, I like writing fantasy. I like things where the unbelievable becomes believable and the impossible becomes possible. So I try to sort of write stories that might seem a bit far-fetched, but hopefully children will enjoy them and imagine themselves in the protagonist sort of role.
So your book that you've sort of redone a bit that you wrote 30 years ago, does it still stand today? I mean, have you reread it and thought, oh my goodness, what have I written? Or have you thought, oh, that's actually quite good, we can do something with that?
Well, one of my favourite books when I was a little girl was Enid Blyton's Naughtiest Girl in the School. Not because I was naughty, it was probably because I wasn't naughty that I enjoyed it. And I must admit, reading it a few years ago, my own story, I thought, oh gosh, it's a bit old-fashioned, you know. So I have tried to bring it up to date, and I can see that it would fit in this world. And in fact, I've got a granddaughter, and I know that you're not supposed to sort of listen to what family says, but she's desperate for me to get it published. So she enjoyed it, and I thought, well, if I can change the language to the sort of language that my granddaughter would use, because she's 10, then maybe it would be fit for today's children.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, you've got the perfect audience there, haven't you, asking your grandkids if they're the right age?
I know. Well, it's amazing, you know, and I sort of listen to what she says, and actually for Charlie Palmer says, I sort of said, would you say settee or would you say sofa? Because to me, a settee is a settee, but she said, oh, no, I'd say sofa. So I've changed, you know, the wording. And
oh, so clever.
Trying to bring it up to date.
Yeah, well done. Well, if people want to get a copy of Charlie Palmer Says, it's available to buy on our website in the TRE bookshop section, and it's by Beverly Bowery, who we've been chatting to today. Beverly, thanks so much for joining us, and best of luck with the book.
Thanks, Hannah. It's been my pleasure. Thank you very much.
The TRE Book Show is sponsored by Audible. Click on the Audible banner on the talkradioeurope.com homepage to download your free audiobook today. Terms and conditions apply.
The Book Programme. Presented by Hannah Murray.
Joining us on the line now is Richard Granger, who's worked as a teacher, personal trainer, restaurateur and journalist. His speciality is finding interest in the mundane and making dull people and their narratives come alive. Losing the Plot is his debut novel and is the first in the Richie Malone series. He's also working on a second novel. His first book, The Last Latrine, is an account of his experiences in Nepal, running the world's highest marathon. He divides his time between Spain and Poland. Welcome to the book show, Richard.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
Oh, it's great to have you with us. And congratulations, your first novel. Is it a very different feeling to a non-fiction book, would you say?
Very much so. I've done some non-fiction before, quite a bit of non-fiction, actually. But this was, it only took me about 6 months to write. So that was quite a surprise, really.
Yeah. And before we talk about this book, I have to ask you about your experiences in Nepal running the world's highest marathon. That sounds like a challenge and a half.
Yeah, it's a long time ago now. I went in 93 and a friend of mine, a former Royal Marine, sort of put me up to it. I did okay. I was the fifth Briton to finish and did a pretty respectable time. Unfortunately, I made the mistake of going back in 97, trying to better my attempts, and had a serious knee injury, which resulted in being airlifted out of Lukla, in a rather, dangerous sort of fashion. So that was quite an experience.
Oh my goodness. How terrifying. So I bet you wish you hadn't bothered the second time.
Well, I do, but actually some good came of it because, my eldest son, who's sadly dead now, was seriously handicapped. And the reason I went was to raise money for the charity that we were connected with, which would ultimately benefit him. And because I ended up not being able to do the race, a guy I met there who was bidding to be the first climber to climb the youngest climber to climb all seven major peaks. He did the marathon on my behalf, and we raised about 40,000, which in 97 was quite a lot.
Yeah, fantastic. So writing a novel then compared to writing the non-fiction book, how did it differ, the whole experience?
Well, they say that in every first novel, there's a certain amount of an autobiographical voice. And I would say that there's probably a little bit of Richie Malone in me, although clearly, I've never, well, not clearly, but I've luckily never woken up next to a dead girl. So the voice was, a lot of people said, you're writing about yourself, which wasn't true, but you do draw on your experience quite heavily when you're writing a novel. And this was sort of no exception.
So tell us about your protagonist then, Richie Malone.
Well, Richie Malone, his narrative arc is basically to become a recognized author of mainstream fiction, and to become, he's a sex addict, so he wishes to cure that side of his character as well and moderate his behaviors. The book opens, he writes pornographic fiction under a female pseudonym, which he keeps very silent about. And Losing the Plot is the narrative of how he ends up in a turf war in Marbella. And this is basically between the Colombian cartel, the Russian mafia, and some Irish gangsters. And he just ends up caught in this which was really not his fault.
And did you have to do a certain amount of research into all those different subjects in order to make the book authentic?
I did. I don't actually know any Russian gangsters or Irish people like that, although I have written another novel, which is set in Ireland during the Troubles, and that's currently being edited, and it needs quite a lot of editing. So I did a considerable amount of research when I was writing that. But a lot of this, it's not a complex book. It's a very light read, and I don't go into a great deal of detail about the background to these people. I just sort of set the scene and let the narrative take over, and their characters.
Yes, because on Amazon, the book comes under erotic mystery fiction, and you're saying it's really not that at all. They like to kind of pigeonhole books, don't they? Put them into categories.
Well, they do. I mean, it's a real shame because I was I was hoping to do a talk for one of these Ladies Do Lunch groups locally, and unfortunately, the lady who runs this, when she found out about this, she said, "Oh, I think that's possibly a bit too spicy for some of my ladies. 40% would love it, but 60%, I'm not so sure." To which I replied, "Well, actually, I don't think it is. It's not erotic fiction. In fact, a friend of mine in Wrocław in Poland, who's an editor, he read it and he said, 'No, they've got that wrong. It's, if anything,' he said, 'it's bloke lit, but it's almost a romantic novel.'" So you don't have any control over what Amazon actually. And on the one hand, it's very nice for it to go in as number three bestseller, but then sometimes perhaps the genre might put people off.
Yes. And you've already started writing the second book, Saving Dave.
I have, yeah. Do you want a brief resume?
Yeah, sure.
Okay. This comes from, as I said earlier, I had a handicap child who died when he was 27. And it might sound strange, but he was profoundly handicapped. And I always wondered what he could actually understand. I mean, the ostensible thing was nothing or very, very little. And so I started writing this about 6 months ago now. And it's about a young man who's 18, who is a quadriplegic, but he suffers from locked-in syndrome. And nobody actually knows this, so his whole world is very, very frustrating. He gains everything, all his knowledge, either from conversations that he overhears, most of which are trivial, or from BBC Radio 4, which is left on in his bedroom all the time. Eventually, something happens that changes his life in quite a dramatic way. I don't really want to reveal what that is, but it's a journey of Dave. What he actually really wants to be in life is a journalist. And I'm not going to say whether he ends up achieving that or not, but this is his particular journey from a very, very unpleasant and unhappy situation, and things do get better.
Oh, fantastic. It sounds like a great idea for a book, and I'm sure it was inspired in some way by your son and what he went through, was it?
It is indeed, yeah. I mean, my editor, who lives in Mallorca, actually, she's very enthusiastic about this and said that there hasn't never been a novel that she's aware of that has been written on this subject. That there have been, there was a guy whose name I can't remember who did dictate a book by blinking his eye. And he died shortly after he completed this. And then there's The Butterfly and the Diving Bell, which is quite a well-known film, which deals with the aspect of locked-in syndrome. I'd have to say it is a black comedy, and that might sound a bit weird, but Dave has got a very interesting perspective of life, and he doesn't have control over things. for example, at one point he's basically forced to do a parachute jump, which he really didn't want to do because he doesn't like flying, and he's strapped to an instructor, but he does manage to get revenge on the people who made him do it. So there's quite a lot of comedy in it, but then there are some fairly serious issues as well.
Oh, fantastic. Well, if people want to get a copy of Losing the Plot, it's available now and is available to buy on our website in the TRE bookshop section. And we'd love to chat to you again when Saving Dave comes out. So please do let us know.
I will indeed. Yeah, thank you very much.
Okay, Richard Granger, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you. Bye now.
The Book Programme, presented by Hannah Murray.
You've been listening to a TRE production. If you've enjoyed this programme, there'll be another episode waiting for you next week, right here on this platform, where you can also access our extensive back catalogue of shows and interviews. For more information on our live programming, social media channels and apps, and how to contact Talk Radio Europe, please visit tre.radio.